This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
The eyes to the right, 286. The nose to the left, 344. So the nose have it, the nose have it. Unlock.
Order, order. Division.
Unlock.
I can't do a Burko. You did a very good one last week. I had people texting me saying, you know, there's perhaps a career for Ed as a John Burko tribute act.
That's Dizzy Heights.
So what was that we just heard there?
Well, that was Meaningful Vote 2.5.
Why not Meaningful Vote 3? Because she stripped out the political declaration.
Yes, because she was trying to get the withdrawal agreement through. But it didn't. I mean, 58, I mean, that's still quite a big majority against, isn't it, after all the arm twisting and all of that.
So I've had to come and meet you,
yes,
and have a cup of tea with you at your place of work, where usually you're just inviting the likes of
George Ezra for lunch.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to ask me what's going to happen next, aren't you?
Mm.
I don't know. Monday's indicative vote 2.
How was indicative vote 1 for you?
Well, actually, you know, the debate in indicative vote 1 was very, very good. Because it wasn't the normal Yabu sucks to you sort of people chucking stuff at each other. They made the case for that. I mean, it was I sat through 2 or 3 hours of it, and it was really good. It was really high quality. It obviously wasn't definitive in terms of the outcome, although it wasn't expected to be. I mean, hopefully we can sort of move towards more of a clearer view on Monday, but you know, it's obviously very difficult because people are very entrenched. It sounds critical, but I don't mean in a critical way. People are very kind of want their own options.
So if you were a betting man, what's going to happen?
I genuinely don't know. I mean, I think it's going to be hard to find a resolution. I think that's probably stating the obvious, but I don't think there's going to be an easy resolution around the corner.
Well, that's great news. Why can't you give us a reason to be cheerful around Brexit?
But I think, so we've sort of generally been a Brexit-free zone, haven't we? And,
yeah.
And this week we're talking, I think we're sort of inching into the Brexit tree sort of arena, but hopefully in a positive way. Today, this week, we're talking about coastal towns. Now, 1 in 6 people live in coastal communities. 1 in 6 people in the UK, that's 11 million people. The top 5 areas for leave voting were coastal towns. And, you know, we are talking about what can we do to help coastal communities. And I actually think this is a sort of microcosm of the wider debate about areas that haven't benefited from prosperity, that have been left out, that, you know, have great people, great businesses in them, but haven't had the investment that is required. And I think it's a really fascinating subject, and we've got some great guests.
And we're joined this week, I should mention, by a comedian pitching some ideas. She's a fantastic musical comedian. Jess Robinson will be pitching her ideas.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that.
So what's your reason to be cheerful this week then? Is it MV 2.5?
My reason to be cheerful is springtime.
It's here.
Thank goodness. It also marks the start of the baseball season. My team, the Boston Red Sox, defending World Series champions, played their first game last night. They lost badly, but never mind.
They've been doing well up until
this point,
doing,
and they've got 161 games to go. So.
Yeah. Okay, well, congratulations on spring arriving, baseball starting, lambing season.
Exactly.
Daffodils.
What's your reason to be cheerful?
I did another one of my trips to Liverpool the other day for my show on American radio, my Beatles show. And I got to go to a museum. It's called the Magical Beatles Museum. It's set up by the brother of Pete Best, who confusingly is also the son of the Beatles' right-hand man, a guy called Neil Aspinall. And the things in there for Beatles geeks, there was a carrier bag from the Beatles shop. They had a shop called the Apple Boutique on Baker Street where they sold clothes, so that was exciting for me to see. They had some.
Well, they had a shop. The Beatles
had a shop. Yeah, they had a clothes shop on Baker Street, and they painted it, this huge psychedelic mural on the outside of the building. And then Westminster Council came along and said, "We don't like that. You've got to paint it white instead." And they ended up being sick of the shop and giving away. In those days, it was £20,000 worth of stock.
What's there now?
I think it's just a Barclays Bank or something like that now. They had some of Pete Best's old drums there. They had some of John Lennon's garden furniture. For somebody like me, this was heaven, Beatle geek heaven.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
On the line now, we have Fernanda Bellata, who is Senior Programme Manager at the New Economics Foundation. Fernanda leads on coastal economies and co-wrote the Blue New Deal report, which we're going to be talking about. And the NEF is a think tank that promotes social, economic and environmental justice. Fernanda, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So just to try and start with a picture of how life is in those communities. A sixth of the British population, which is more than 11 million people, live in coastal communities across islands, fishing villages, port towns and cities. And all of the top five local authorities with the highest leave vote in the 2016 referendum were on the coast. Can you talk to me a little bit about why these communities face specific challenges? What is it about life in those towns which made them more likely to vote leave in the referendum?
Right. So I have to start always when I talk about coastal communities, I have to start by saying that those are amazing communities with, you know, an amazing lifestyle living on the coast. That's why a lot of people retire to the coast. That's why a lot of people want to move to the coast when they do. You know, it's the amazing coastal environment. So, you know, there's lots of positives, you know, really strong communities, the ones that I've been meeting for the past few years traveling around the coast. But they do face a lot of challenges. They are complex challenges. So the first thing I'll say is that when looking at coastal communities as one group of communities in the UK, you see higher levels of deprivation, unemployment, educational underachievement. Those are economies that have been lacking diversity and dynamism. So many areas, for example, are heavily dependent on tourism, which is a seasonal industry. And that means that they lack resilience, really. So it makes them less able to cope with any shocks to the economy or environmental shocks, like the effects of climate change, for example. And what has been happening in coastal communities is something that has been happening with other communities in the country, which is that they have never really recovered from the loss or decline of traditional industries, such as fishing, shipbuilding, or the glory days of British seaside tourism. And what hasn't happened is a coherent plan to reinvent coastal economies and to support them in filling those gaps that have been left for too long there. So they're really living a cycle of disadvantage. That's how I see it. Areas that are most in need are also the least attractive to investment. So there's a challenge there in how do we basically make a change? You know, how do we transform what's happening right now?
And a potential answer to that is this Blue New Deal that the New Economics Foundation propose. Can you talk to us about the deal, what that proposes and what it would involve?
Yeah, so the Blue New Deal is a vision and also a plan for the UK coast. So it's first saying that the starting point for Blue New Deal should be coastal communities' most unique asset, what sets them apart, the reason why we talk about them, which is the coastal marine environment. And so if you're looking at, you know, creating a healthier coastal and marine environment and really supporting those resources on which communities heavily depend on, what does that mean then for economic development? How do we think about the activities we're going to be investing in? You know, how we will invest in them differently? And so the Blue New Deal is very much about, you know, focusing investment in the activities industry, such as, you know, tourism has a potential to be, you know, a good positive economic force. It's not doing the job yet, but it could be better. Fisheries could be, we could drive really sustainable fisheries for real in the UK. We could invest more in renewable energy. We could invest more in other industries as well that could be set on the coast. But in order to address the challenges on why certain industries, for example, the digital economy hasn't been thriving on the coast, you know, a place that people would probably like to go and, you know, sit in the sunshine and then go to the office and do very remote work, for example. The reason for that is because of the complex challenges. So now I go back to the more systemic issues for the coast is that it sits on the periphery of the UK economy. So they lack connectivity. So sometimes it's really hard just for people to relocate to the coast because of transport infrastructure. Broadband connectivity might not be so good. So what the Blue New Deal is saying is that there's all this potential on the coast and communities are doing already and could be doing a lot more with the right support. But there is a need for a national framework of investment and particular look at the coast. And so that's why we talk about a coastal industry strategy. but also about, you know, if you're thinking about national infrastructure in the UK, you need to have a coastal element to it. There are particular challenges for the coast. If you're talking about skills, there is a particular need, you know, on the coast in terms of the types of skills or reskilling or retraining of people.
And why is infrastructure historically so poor in those coastal communities? Is it sort of literally because they are the peripheries of the country?
Well, it all starts with the UK economy being heavily centered in and around London. You know, what that means, obviously, is that transport routes will go where the money is, basically, you know, where investment is, where the businesses are locating. Coastal communities have been kind of peripheral, and like they survived on lots of traditional industries, such as fisheries and tourism. There wasn't so much of a care of how that could have been addressed, you know, as the economy continue to heavily center on, in London and other areas.
What does a better version of tourism look like in British coastal towns? You mentioned there was this heyday of tourism in this country in those towns, and a lot of them, you know, you see it's faded, it's not there anymore. What does a better, more modern, more sustainable and actually year-round version of that look like?
There's quite a lot happening in this space now. So to say that tourism on the coast is actually not doing very bad, but it's just that in comparison with tourism in the country, it sits in the margins, you know, and it doesn't get the attention that it deserves. And so, but coastal tourism in the UK has been competing, you know, with cheap tourism abroad, you know, in Europe, you know, in places that have maybe, you know, more sunshine and so forth, and people want to go. So what we're saying is that if you actually look at tourism as alongside other industries and other activities on the coast, then that's the potential really for tourism. So, for example, there are lots of communities that are combining fishing heritage. So it's about safeguarding the fishing heritage of an area. And I'm talking about small boats, you know, and that kind of feeling and being able to buy and eat local catch and so forth. So combining that with a tourism strategy, for example, which gives really a character to an area, which is what people want to visit, right? People want to go and see places with character, places that have a history, places that showing are able to really able to feel the uniqueness of a place.
And how do you get around this problem of employment in the tourism industry often being seasonal and having low wages, and then it's not stable for those communities?
Yeah, I think part of the answer of that is also what I've been talking about in terms of, you know, a more holistic view and a better strategic planning in terms of economic development in an area, meaning tourism not being seen on its own, but alongside other industries. If communities are thinking about all these things, they are coming up with good ideas, they're trying to do those things which would ensure year-round jobs, employment, but they still have to deal with something that it's beyond what they can do at a local level, which is if people are not able to access those places, then it's about transport connectivity. If, you know, if businesses are not able to locate that because of poor broadband, it is about, you know, a wider kind of investment strategy at a national level. There's also a matter of skills. So if you're thinking about new types of jobs, places that have been left behind for too long, you know, and they haven't been invested in, that means also that they have been suffering from educational underachievement, and or people just need reskilling really to tap into new opportunities.
And let me ask you also about fish. Fish is a controversial issue, not least in the context of Brexit. Talk to us about fishing and our coastal communities and what we should sort of understand about the sort of common fisheries policy and where fishing policy needs to go sort of post whatever happens on Brexit.
Right. So fishing is a fascinating issue in the UK, certainly. I think the first thing you need to understand about the fishing debate is that the fishing industry is not one industry. So when we talk about, you know, fishing and Brexit, you know, there are different stories there. You have, you know, heavily concentrated fishing quotas, which are, you know, the kind of amount of fish that UK boats can catch. They are heavily concentrated in the hands of the big boats. And so about 70% of the employment in the fishing industry in the UK is actually on small boats, but they only get about 2% of the quota of the amount of fish that we can catch. That has always been in the hands of the UK government, the power to change that. The EU and the Common Fisheries Policy would, you know, the EU member states would agree the number of quotas each country could get, but the country itself has always been responsible for how they distribute that within their country. So what does that mean to coastal communities is that small boats that constitute the majority of jobs in the UK are the ones that are contributing the most to the local coastal economies. And they have also that connection, right? So it's people who live there and who have a direct kind of connection to the supply chain as well and to all the other businesses in that area.
An issue I wanted to ask you about was second homes, middle-class people buying holiday homes, which they are rarely at. How does that factor into the deal, and what is that doing to coastal communities?
That is an issue in many communities in the UK. I'll give you one example of St Ives, because one, the issue is great there. When you go to St Ives and you visit the seafront, a spectacular, you know, views, an amazing place. If you go off the season, so off summer, you know, you have all these buildings and houses on the seafront that are shut down. They're not being used. And it's really sad. I mean, it's the most, you know, prominent bit of the town. So what has happened over the years is that the local population has had to move away from the sea, from the most valued area. And that's as a result of lots of second home ownership. And St. Ives is interesting because it has had this issue. The local community has, you know, been obviously not happy with that for a long time. And a few years ago, they voted for neighborhood plans to ban second home ownership. And they were successful and actually became an international example.
But are there some ways in which this helps the communities as well? Is there an economic benefit to people buying houses in towns which might be struggling otherwise and coming in and maybe different types of businesses opening to cater for those people?
I'm not saying that, you know, second homes are always a bad thing. But I think certainly St. Ives, I'm used as an example because it hasn't generated benefits for the local area. And I think that's when anything becomes a bad thing. You know, if you're investing in a place by buying a house, for example, then that needs to be linked to how are you generating public benefit in some way or supporting a community in some way or creating jobs, you know, if it is the case.
The New Economics Foundation has founded something called the Centre for Coastal Economies to work with coastal communities. Can you tell us about that and some of the projects that you've worked with?
Yes, so the Centre for Coastal Economies is basically our programme of work to support the implementation of a Blue New Deal. What we've been doing is just supporting communities with specific projects or with, you know, a way for them to engage with economic change. So we're working with a community on the East Coast. Can't talk about the name yet. It's just a project in development, which is about how coastal communities can do coastal management in a different way. What that means is that, you know, for a long time, development on the coast, so building on the coast, has meant that we have degraded lots of the coastal habitats, which has made them then less able to cope with, for example, sea level rise and big storms, which means increased risk of flooding in areas. So actually, there are better ways that are good for nature and more resilient for local communities to manage our coast if we do more natural processes, sometimes allowing some areas to flood and generate new habitats that are more rich in biodiversity, for example, and can create new opportunities for tourism in terms of, you know, this area, for example, would greatly benefit from windsurfing, which is something that it's really a new type of like water sports and can bring in new types of visitors as well to the area. So there's lots of opportunities when you start to think about, you know, okay, so how can we support the local environment, so really the resilience of this place, and what benefits then that generates to local people, and then what does that mean for new economic opportunities? And that's the process that we're going through with different communities in the country.
I've got one final question, Fernando. We have a thing on the podcast called the Jeffocracy, which is a slightly strange idea, which is that Jeff becomes the supreme ruler And I mean, clearly it's kind of a relatively dangerous proposition, but speaking as we are on the day of...
Careful, you are jeopardising your position as Minister for Windsurfing.
Where we don't... Now that you've told me I've got that position, I'm much more positive. So we've got this brilliant, positive, utopian vision of a Jeffocracy with me as Minister for Windsurfing. If Jeff made you Minister for Coastal Communities, what's the first thing that you would do in the Jeffocracy?
So I think the first thing I would do is set up within the existing institutions, so local authorities, local enterprise partnerships, make sure that there was a coastal group which had, you know, genuinely the representation from the local areas to start to think of what a Blue New Deal would look like for their region and their area, and really allow and give the right amount of support for those groups to develop their strategies. Through that, link that up with all the things that we already have in policy in terms of the investment that it's needed in renewable energy and tourism in places, but really do it in a way that it's in response to what these areas think that they need. And I'm saying this because right now there isn't such a thing, right? So the coast tends to lose out in regional plans. They're not only catering for the coast, so local authorities and local enterprise partnerships, which right now hold either the power or the money at a local level for many of these things, they tend to almost forget. I mean, is that cycle of disadvantage that I mentioned. So I think as a starting point to really give legitimacy to some of those coastal groups, and, you know, and bringing the ones that already exist and just legitimizing them to be able to develop and say what they need and what they want, so that it would then inform government on what kind of investment it would then make.
And then the final thing I wanted to ask you is, there may be some sort of dangers of not exactly corruption in the Jeffocracy, but I think he's going to want to have a nice time. Where would you recommend he sets up his coastal HQ?
Yes.
I mean, it's as part of economic development, obviously, not the sort of enrichment of
It's not a second
Jeff's
home,
life.
So St. Ives could be nice.
It's not. Where's I can sort of see him in the sort of in his coastal HQ,
yes.
You know, walking along the beach, sort of, you know, thinking about the big decisions you've got to make.
Okay, I'll say one that really impressed me when I visited for the first time last year, which was Scarborough.
Scarborough.
All right, I'm there.
Yeah.
Jeff's coastal HQ in Scarborough. I think we're all looking forward to it. Fernanda Balacha, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're delighted to be joined now by Nick Taylor, who is former Renaissance manager in Scarborough. Nick, I wanted to congratulate you, first of all, because we were just talking to Fernanda Balacha from the New Economics Foundation. We asked her where should be the coastal headquarters in the Jeffocracy, a thing we have on this podcast, which is a kind of utopia, and she selected Scarborough. So congratulations on being selected.
Well, that's brilliant news. Excellent. Well, I'll buy her an ice cream when she comes up here. That'd be lovely.
So you were part of the Scarborough Renaissance Partnership. Can you, first of all, start by just telling us about the regeneration of Scarborough, what type of a place it is, how it's been transformed over the past decade, what's happened in the town, where things are going?
I was a hotel manager running one of the larger properties in the town, and the whole Renaissance roadshow rolled into town as part of the activity back in the early 2000s done by the regional development agencies. And Yorkshire Ford, of course, was our one for this part of the world, which is a brilliant, brilliant organisation. They gave some really serious leadership to the whole region, and they started asking, what could we do to improve your town? And as a hotel manager, I was terribly aware of the economic performance of the hotel, the yields of the hotels in seaside towns are poor. So these are things we're all very aware of. And other aspects like poor levels of aspiration of kids leaving school. We hemorrhaged our kids at the age of 18, rather, when they finished doing their A-levels, go to university and we'd never see them again. And all that led to a bit of a shame for the economy. The whole attitude was, well, it's only Scarborough, that will do. When the RDAs rocked up and said, right, it's all about raising the quality and raising the profit and performance of your businesses, but raising the place for the local community to be a great place to live. And what's more, making the place into a 365-day-a-year town, as opposed to one that closes down largely in the winter. And we had a good deal of success in Scarborough. We won a thing called Britain's Most Enterprising Town. That put us into the Europeans, and we won Europe's Most Enterprising Place in 2009. And the legacy of that has stood us in very good stead. And we've got great new businesses setting up. We discovered a few years ago that it was a real struggle getting kids into the engineering sector, which is very big in this town. Engineering does more here than tourism in the way of GDP. So as an outcome of that was we opened a university technical college through the Baker Deering Trust.
What were some of the other ideas and initiatives and schemes that have helped with the regeneration?
Well, a lot of them were about raising the quality. So we ran a programme about Scarborough's, the hospitality sector. It was all about raising the quality. It wasn't about putting the price up and making the, like, it wasn't, what we didn't want to do was marginalise the sort of the lower cost thing. So we didn't want the people who didn't have a lot of money when they came here on their holidays, we didn't want to penalise them and just take the place up market now to their reach. It was a case of how do you make a fish and chip shop better? Well, you just encourage the guy behind the counter to smile a bit more and to have a clean waistcoat on and a clean apron and not dirty fingernails. Oh, and smile at the customers. So this whole programme of activity was launched, and we had some remarkable results. And it really started to raise the game and the aspirations of the town.
Nick, Scarborough voted, I think, 62% for leave in the referendum, the Brexit referendum. What do you attribute that to? Is that part of the issues that Scarborough faces around regeneration, quality of jobs and all that?
I think an awful lot of people came out to vote who haven't done much voting before, who thought that really leaving was the best thing to do, that it would actually bring more jobs for local people into the town instead of there being people employed who were from elsewhere in Europe. I think people just voted because they wanted to see some change.
We're talking on the day, which is not an unusual day, and that we don't know what's going to happen.
Exactly.
With Brexit and all that. What do you think, whatever happens with Brexit, government of whatever stripe needs to do for places like Scarborough, building on the success that you've already achieved?
Well, thank you for that. It's the big thing is the education, Ed. Our schools locally are funded along the lines of they don't get the level of funding as if we were in inner cities. And our problems on many of our housing estates around the town are exactly the same as they've got in the inner cities. We're funded like a shire county, if you get my drift, and they are being cut continually. 2% cuts this year in the education system, with just as many students going through the door. And what we're finding is that the level of outcome of the secondary schools is really not where it should be.
In terms of the industrial future of somewhere like Scarborough, is it mainly tourism? Are there sort of other economic development aspects that are important?
No, tourism is doing okay, but the engineering sector here and the knowledge economy is growing very well. We're also lucky. I mean, we're just lucky enough to have the now big outpost of the GCHQ, and as Cheltenham is now full effectively, they're employing a lot of people up here.
Well, that will be good for Jeff when he has his coastal HQ, because he'll be able to keep in touch with
Jeff,
intelligence matters.
We need somebody who's done Piccadilly Radio and all that sort of stuff over here in Scarborough, Jeff. We need you here. Really.
Last question, Nick. So we're conjuring this picture of Jeff with his coastal HQ in Scarborough.
And panoramic sea views.
I think I'd say you've got
panoramic
to be careful
on
the planning issues there. Just make sure he doesn't, like, you know, take you for a ride. If he made you his sort of chief advisor on coastal issues, what's the first thing you would do, not simply for Scarborough, but sort of across the country?
It's about energising people, Ed. It's about getting the people realising that they can make a difference. They don't have to sit back and wait for a local authority to do something. Because there are funds out there. I mean, the Coastal Communities Fund, for example, is one which we can tap into. And that's funded largely by the Crown Estate. And it's about channelling those funds into getting the best outcome, into delivering jobs and into delivering, an improved economy in the seaside towns, not relying completely on tourism. But also, a lot of what we did was actually to make the town a better place to live. And it was about trying to make the place, if it's nice enough for the people to come and who live here to go and use the restaurants and cafes and pubs and shops and such like, that's going to benefit the visitors as well. Because so often towns feel disenfranchised because everything's done for the visitor economy and not for the locals. And by consulting with the locals, we got this buy-in, if you like, from them, that they then started to recognise that the community could start improving the place for themselves.
Sounds very good. Let's hope Jeff's arrival doesn't put people off.
We'd love it. Give us a shout, Jeff. You've got my contact details. We'd love to see you.
Yeah, and I want to know where this best fish and chip shop with the nice waistcoats is.
Nick Teller, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Nice to talk to you all. Thank you for the call.
Now we're heading to the other end of the country, to the south coast, and I'm delighted to say that we've got Sam Scriven, who's the programme manager at the Jurassic Coast Trust, on the line. Sam, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So can you start by telling us what the Jurassic Coast is for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with it, and the story of what you've been doing?
So the geography of the Jurassic Coast is it's a 95-mile stretch of the Dorset and East Devon coastline. So that stretches from Exmouth in East Devon right the way along to Studland Bay in Dorset. So within that, you've got Budley Salterton, Sidmouth, Lyme Regis, Seaton, Beer, Weymouth, Portland, Lulworth, Kimmeridge and Swanage. So lots and lots of seaside towns. Oh, and of course, West Bay, made famous by Broadchurch, of course, in the last few years. It's a World Heritage Site, so that's part of this global UNESCO programme, which is all about helping them to deliver their mission to improve peaceful relations between nations. So it's quite a big political idea. And these are places that have outstanding universal value. So their heritage value transcends economic and political boundaries. And the Jurassic Coast won this status in 2001, based on its amazing geology, fossils and natural landforms. So it's not about the wildlife and the beauty, our World Heritage status, interestingly, it's just the geology. And what we've got is a remarkable rock record, which spans 185 million years of Earth's history.
And tell us about some of the challenges that the area faces, and what the sort of how the designation has helped you and how you're coping with some of those challenges.
Like a lot of coastal communities, there's a fair bit of deprivation, especially places like Weymouth and Portland. And I suppose for the whole coast, something like World Heritage status is hugely valuable for lots of different ways, and some of them are a little bit nuanced and not necessarily something you can easily put a kind of price tag on. In terms of deprivation, of course, conservation, environmental conservation, isn't a panacea for the kinds of economic deprivation that places like Weymouth and Portland and other towns suffer from. But it is an important lever to help inspire investment, inspire innovation and those kinds of things. And the quality of the environment is also something that has just a kind of wider benefit. So we did an economic study, well, Dorset County Council did an economic study into the value of Dorset's natural environment, and that included the Dorset Area of Outstanding Natural Beauty, but also the Jurassic Coast stretching down into East Devon, and found that the World Heritage status influenced around £100 million of economic activity every year. But that was to do with the quality of the environment as a draw for not just tourism and the growth in tourism, but also just the something that inspires people to move here, to live here, to stay here, to establish their businesses here, because they want to be within this landscape of very high quality.
If we made you Minister for Coastal Communities in the utopia we have on this podcast, the Jeffocracy, what is the first thing, if I gave you carte blanche, I'm busy staring out to sea from the Jurassic Coast, what is the first thing you do on day one?
I mean, in my experience, the policy level towards the environment and climate change and coastal communities and the threats that sea level rise and things like that pose, the policy level mostly says all the right things. But when you get down to the level at which the decisions are made on a day-to-day basis, there's not really very much political will there to face up to these challenges. There's a bit of the "we'll do it later" kind of attitude. You know, we'll just carry on doing what we've always done, which is generally sort of defending the coast and so on with hard defences and investing in those kinds of things. We'll just carry on doing that for the next 10 or 20 years, and then after that we'll start to face up to the real challenges. But, you know, in the meantime, as sea levels rise, if you want to take it to this sort of worst-case scenario, you've got all these seaside towns that have a beach with a promenade behind it, which is a hard coastal defence. As sea levels rise, that hard coastal defence isn't going anywhere. The only thing that's going to be squeezed out is the beach. And then all of a sudden, you've lost the basis for your local economy, or one of the, you know, pillars of the local economy. So making these changes, facing up to them at that ground level where the decisions are made, is really, really key. So if I was in government, the first thing I do is to really invest heavily in empowering people at the local level to be able to make constructive decisions and plans to adapt to these things.
You also answered a question there that I had in my head, but I didn't want to say out loud through fear of seeming stupid or even more stupid than usual, which is we've heard a lot about coastal towns, and one of the problems has been people going abroad on cheap holidays for better weather. And part of me is thinking, well, I mean, we all know there's all these terrible effects of climate change, but is one of the benefits maybe for these coastal towns is that the it's going to be warmer, so people are less likely to go abroad. But what you're saying is the sort of impact in terms of water levels would actually be very damaging.
Well, that's long term, of course. I mean, thinking very long term now, really, next 100 years or so. But that's the thing. That's the threat of climate change, the sort of the sword of Damocles, if you like, hanging over the whole thing, is that we have a tourism economy here based on a coast that is in a particular condition right now. And if the history of our planet tells us anything, is that change is inevitable. And with climate change, the predictions with climate change, the increase in storminess, increase in sea level, the nature of how we use our coastlines is inevitably going to change, and maybe change quite significantly in the next few decades. So I just really think it's important to get in early and be able to empower people to adapt, be aware of those changes and plan for them right now, because it takes a long time, doesn't it, to make those kinds of changes to communities and the way we work and live.
Sam Scriven, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So what do you think then?
I thought that was a really excellent discussion, and I think I need to sort of, you know, fess up here, which is it was a bit like the sortition episode where I was very sceptical in advance. I wasn't quite sure what the point of it was going to be, but I think the point of it, the fish scales fell from my eyes, which is, I think this goes to the heart of the sort of post-Brexit or whatever we do on Brexit kind of conundrum, which is because there hasn't been a proper industrial policy in the country, lots of areas haven't shared in the prosperity that there's been in other parts of the country. And in a way, I think there's in the public debate, in the media and public debate, the sort of model for this is quote-unquote northern towns. Now, you know, I represent Doncaster North. You know, I think places like Doncaster have missed out too much, although there are great things going on, has missed out too much on government investment, all of those things. But I think coastal towns just aren't talked about nearly as much. And it's partly because they're not maybe represented in the same way by, you know, one political party, generally Labour MPs, not always Labour MPs, but generally, you know, who kind of are increasingly speaking, you know, more and more about these things. You know, they're in different parts of the country. So do you know what I mean? But I think it is as much an issue, certainly given the numbers who live in coastal towns, as places like Doncaster.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
If you've got thoughts about what you've heard about coastal towns or suggestions for future episodes, you can email us, reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. You can find us on Twitter at @cheerfulpodcast and on Instagram, the same address. And you can also find us on facebook.com/reasons-to-be-cheerful-podcast. And do remember to rate us on your podcast app, iTunes or whatever. 5 stars, please, because not just because we want to improve our self-esteem, but because it's good for other people to get to listen, isn't it?
Yes, and there is a lot of room for improvement in our self-esteem too.
The mystery of the iTunes chart. Talking of self-esteem, Your mother-in-law has emailed us. Lynn Barron, come on down.
Don't read it out. It only encourages
her. She's back. She's back and she's bad. so it doesn't actually have sort of much personal content. It's like, dear Ed and Jeff, or anything. She says, reasons to be cheerful. It's like a memo.
Right.
It's a memo from your mother-in-law. Reasons to be cheerful, topic, colon, developing programs to promote self-esteem early on in girls in order for them to feel more valued for intelligence, to be encouraged to have a strong voice, have a sense of self-worth, and consequently to find themselves less victimized. Suggestion for guest, colon, Michelle Obama.
Of course! Why didn't we think of that?
This is a cause very dear to her heart. I think she would bite. Lynn Barron. I mean,
what a great suggestion.
She's obviously feeling very warm towards you at the moment, your mother-in-law. So it's a good memo from Lynn Barron. She sends the best memos.
Thank you. Any members of our families or friendship circles who want to get in touch, it's reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com.
What do you think about that, then? Do you think that Michelle Obama would be pleased to...
Go on? I don't see where you're going with this.
Podcast?
Do you have an in? Could we tweet her?
My impression is that she's obviously a bit desperate for sales, but she's only sold 10 million copies of her book, Becoming.
So we could get her up to 10 million and 20.
Yeah, so she obviously needs like a few more sales to just kind of push her over the top. So, yeah. maybe there's a possibility.
Yeah. I mean, we do get pitched a lot of guests, you know, so we'd have to see if we could fit her in. We have quite a tight schedule.
We are starting to think about who we want to see on podcast number 100.
Yes.
We're currently at number 80. This is number 80. So, if people have thoughts on that, be grateful to hear them.
I keep saying Ringo Starr, but Ed isn't keen.
Well, failing that, Lynn Barron.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet @cheerfulpodcast.
And here to pitch us some ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful, we're joined by comedian Jess Robinson. Hello, Jess.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. And you're out on tour at the moment.
I am. I've got a tour on called No Filter at the moment, which is full of musical impressions and stand-up and everything, really. It's lots of fun.
We had Beardy Man on recently, and he could do not musical impressions, but he could do impressions of various different objects like machine guns and helicopters.
Oh, I do people.
Uh-huh. Who do you do then?
I do Teresa sometimes. I've just started to do Olivia Colman as well. She's amazing, isn't she?
That's really good.
Don't really care. A little bit of Cheryl. Do you know Cheryl?
Yep.
Everybody knows her. And then I do singers like Lily Allen and Catherine Jenkins. Oh, mio bambino caro. And Britney.
Very good.
Oh, baby, baby. Like, anyone you like, really.
Very good. If only they were doing a Celebrity Stars in Their Eyes.
My show is like Celebrity Stars in Their Eyes. I've got them all in my mouth. That sounds wrong.
How do you discover you can do people's singing voices? Is it by singing along with the radio?
Yeah, I did. That's how I started. My auntie was into Kate Bush, and when I heard her voice, I just put down all the take that and all the stuff that my friends were listening to and thought that Kate Bush was the best thing I had ever heard, with that incredible, out on the wily windy Mars voice. She was like a...
You've obviously got a very good voice, though, to be able to do this.
Well, I had classical singing lessons.
Oh.
And I wanted to... I had a place at Bristol Uni to go and do a music degree, and I was going to do classical singing.
I see.
And then I realised it was more fun to make people laugh.
Let me ask you a question. Is there anybody you've tried and you just can't get?
Can't do any men. I could probably do Joe Pasquale. Can't do any men or Alison Moyet. They're too low.
Jess, you brought along some ideas.
I've got some ideas to fix the world
and give us reasons to be cheerful. What is the first one?
I am a bit of a people pleaser, and I hate any sort of confrontation. It makes me, I balk at it.
Mm. You're really at home here. That's exactly what we're like.
Yes.
No, seriously.
Seriously.
We just want everyone to be nice to each other.
Yeah, exactly, totally.
But, you know, sometimes you do have to express some difficult feelings, and you have to have different opinions to people sometimes. And so I think that to make it a bit easier, you should sing at each other, because it just relieves the tension. So if you could, I really think you've got bad breath. But that sounds much nicer than, oh, my gosh, your breath is so bad, doesn't it?
Yeah, so performance.
It makes the other person feel better.
Courageous conversations.
Courageous yes. conversations, yeah. So I thought that could go into Prime Minister's Question Time. That would get less brutal. And if people want to interrupt and go, and all of that stuff, they have to do it in harmony.
There is a weird thing, though. When British politicians try anything like that, it never goes as well as it seems to. Like, for example, with Obama. Obama would sing from time to time. He'd sort of burst into...
He sang Amazing Grace when there was this... terrible shooting in the south.
I think
the church in the south.
British politicians mustn't think that they're doing something cool or trying to. They should just embrace the very fact that they have to sing. That there shouldn't be anything like trying to be meaningful or cool about it. It's just something that you do.
I think it'll make people less mean anyway.
Okay. It would. So that's
we buy it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're
on. Great.
What's next, Jess?
We like it already.
Oh!
Yeah, definitely.
Those calls.
Definitely.
Right? The calls.
Yeah, definitely.
You pick up, silence, then it goes.
Definitely.
Please hold. Ding, 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 ding.
It's fucking annoying.
It's the worst.
Yeah.
Who's allowed to do this?
I totally agree.
Yeah.
And also, as well as that, can there be a thing that you can opt out of these sales calls? Can you opt out?
I think
you're
supposed to be, but I don't have a landline, but if I go and visit my mum and dad, their phone rings many times a day and every single call is one of those things.
Yeah, because I get it on my mobile.
Yeah, I get it on my mobile too.
Hi, I'd like to speak to you about the recent car accident you were in. And
can
I'm like,
can I just say to you though, after the general election 2015, I was really grateful for the call from PPI.
Your phone wouldn't have ever rung otherwise.
I grabbed the phone.
Talk to me. Talk to me.
Honestly, you know. So there's a role for them.
You never did any of those robot calls when you were canvassing for votes, did you?
I don't think we do them in this country, do we?
Oh, maybe not.
I think it's a very American thing.
It's always a Hastings number on mine.
Really?
Yeah, it's terrible.
Just in Hastings.
Terrible.
God. Yeah, well, okay. We hate those calls. We're with you.
Gone. No more dill.
What?
No more dill.
No, this is. I mean, you,
dill isn't.
This is such an
offensive. Now it's controversial.
This is such an offensive. You should be singing this. It's such an offensive opinion.
Dill. It's the worst herb of all the herbs.
It's one of the greats.
No, it's one of the greats. It's an angry herb.
It's a lovely summery taste.
It's a taste that colours everything it touches.
Of summer.
Does it taste of very much dill?
Oh, it tastes of Satan.
Summer.
Really?
No.
Yeah.
Wow. We've really split opinion on this.
Oh, I can make you a lovely Nigel Slater green bean dish with some yogurt and some dill.
Never made me that.
I will do that. I love it without the dill. No dill.
Oh, I love a bit
of
dill.
You always had this dill.
I need to start an anti-dill
antagonism.
Movement.
Dill phobia.
Do you know where you wouldn't do well?
It ruins all salmon.
Scandinavia. Very big on dill in the Nordic countries.
I went to Iceland, actually, and I tried...
We went to Iceland recently.
Did you?
We had a lovely weekend away. Yeah.
I had a dill cocktail there because I thought, look, let me, you know, you're supposed to eat something 8 times to be able to appreciate it or something. So I tried to have a dill cocktail. Well, I sniffed it, but my nose is quite big, not because I'm Jewish, but it has something to do with it, I'm sure. And my nose went too far in. I don't know the length of my own nose. And so I snorted the dill cocktail. I even had some coming out the corner of my eye.
I mean, you can be arrested for that.
So,
criminal offense.
So have you been traumatised by dill? Is that what's happened here?
I was traumatised before, but that was just the final nail in the coffin. No dill.
Did we have that drink we had in Iceland? Was that dill related or not?
Yeah, maybe it was a bit of dill going on there. So do you not enjoy something pickled with a bit of dill in it?
I don't mind those pickled cucumbers.
Oh, here we go.
I don't mind them, but that's because...
Pickled cucumbers, they have things...
Gherkins.
Are they related to dill?
Well, they've
pickle them with a bit of dill in there.
Dill cucumbers is a thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, but they don't taste very much of dill. They're more about the sweetness and the vinegar and the nice texture and stuff. If dill has a big enough flavour to offset it, that's fine. But it overpowers everything, and it really.
Where do you stand?
I think it's a well-made case.
Where do you stand on coriander?
Coriander's fine.
Interesting.
I know. Some people have the coriander thing, but you can use just a hint of coriander, and it doesn't ruin everything.
Well, I like coriander, but it's genetic. If you spit into a test tube and send it off, they'll send you some results back telling you whether you're predisposed to genetically like coriander or not.
But are you serious?
I don't think that applies with dill.
What?
No, I think only evil people like dill.
Well, I am inherently evil, so that figures.
I'm not going to intervene in the dill
thing. I'm staying out of this one. It's too controversial.
Okay.
All the seeds and raspberries to be removed.
I can get on board with that.
Because a raspberry is a lovely thing, isn't it? And you're eating and it's wonderful. And then for the rest of the day, you are picking out those
but
seeds from the back of your teeth.
It's not doable, is it?
Someone will do it. Someone
genetic
will
modification.
Need the work.
Do you think genetic do you think it's a genetic modification thing? I mean,
or nuns could do it. Blind
they're not
nuns.
Removable.
The ones that do lace.
They're not removable, are they?
I'm sure with a very.
So they probably used to say that about grapes.
Yes.
Can't be done.
No, but that's like
people
one,
like you.
Sorry.
Can't be done.
Sorry. There's a very big difference between a seed in a grape and a seed in a raspberry. I mean, I don't like to be kind of you.
I mean, I'm not talking
dogmatic
not,
about this, but
we're not
there's one seed or two seeds in a grape.
Yeah,
there's multiple millions of
but
seeds.
But at some
in a
point,
raspberry.
Somebody would have been sitting there in your position saying, "Okay, they're inside the grape. How would you get them out?
You get
just
seedless
not think,
clementines.
Not, yes.
You think it's like the sort of creation of the NHS? You know, it's just like it needs a leap of imagination.
Exactly.
Just
yes.
Does.
Yeah. Yeah.
I am not talking pomegranates. I've not gone crazy.
Yeah.
Although,
interesting.
That's another fruit that's spoiled by its seeds, isn't it?
I think I'm not sure I'm with you on the raspberries. I know the
Ed.
Seeds problem.
It's a terrible problem.
The seeds problem is a problem.
You'll get such a sore tongue for taking it out the back of your teeth.
I mean, there is a leap of imagination in all these things. The banning of dill, singing Prime Minister's Question Time. Why can't you take that leap with
the
raspberry seeds?
I just haven't quite crossed the sort of raspberry Rubicon.
I'm amazed at that.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I'm amazed at your
small-mindedness. I'm sorry, you found my bottom line.
Well, how about this one then?
Yeah.
Is it one kiss or two? When you greet somebody, do you go hello, or do you go hello, mwah, mwah, or do you go hello, mwah, 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 or do you go hello, hug?
No one knows.
Decide now, please?
Yeah. I think it's been a sort of anarchic breakdown of any rules that there were on.
Even
this.
Posh people don't know, because if you ever watch sort of upmarket award ceremonies and things, they don't know what they're doing either. They're going the wrong
Terrible.
Way. I try and just close it down.
Which way first? I kissed a producer on the nose the other day by accident in an audition.
But
and
there's also, I mean, I'd say it's a sort of two stage process, really, which is one, what's the stage at which you get to the kiss?
Yes.
And then secondly, is it one or two or three?
You mean, should there be foreplay?
Well, yes. Should it be a greeting?
Yeah.
Or a, you know.
I accidentally greeting. Once ended up with Denise Van Outen's ear in my mouth. It was very embarrassing.
It's terrible, the body parts that people have kissed by accident.
Yeah. I mean, I think we shouldn't be touching each other. That would be a good rule to have in place.
So, right, okay. Does that mean that when you do the kiss, you're just kissing the air? Do you touch cheeks?
Just a little nod.
As in cheeks on your face?
Just little
cheeks.
Nods, like a northerner in a pub.
All right?
Yeah.
Just that?
Yeah. Why must we be touching each other? I think post-Brexit there won't be any of this.
You don't really believe this, do you?
Touching each other.
Hey?
A nice handshake, Anna, and then you pull the person in for one kiss.
But then you get judged on your handshake. Somebody told me that I shake hands like I've got one of those electric buzzers in my hand.
Shake my hand. No, that... You do, you wiggle it. A firm hand, so I'm shaking your hand. No, wow, that's really what you literally shake the person's hand.
Somebody also said to me once, I can tell you went to a comprehensive school from a handshake.
Oh, fuck you, they can fuck off.
I know.
Does that even
Who
mean?
Was that?
It doesn't matter.
Good strong handshake, but you judder it.
Right, so I've got to stop the judder.
Yeah, just a down.
But then it's not a shake. What's the shake bit of the handshake then?
It's a really slow shake.
What are you proposing then?
I'm just proposing that someone, head of kissing in the government.
You should be head of kissing, I think.
Oh.
I think you get the job.
Get it.
Okay. We've not nominated anyone in the Jeffocracy for head of kissing.
It's been a vacant role up until this point.
Okay, it's like Donald Trump's administration. It's been hard to fill the role.
But also what I would let you do is make public information films. You know, like you used to get 100%. The ones about not flying a kite near pylons. It'd be public information films on how to do kissy greetings.
If you do
kissing is a confusing business.
It's a confusing business, yeah. It's like tax doesn't have to be taxing. Kissing doesn't have to be awkward.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. We're
but what
on.
Is it? 2, 1, 3.
I think it's
6.
I think it's 1, 2 hug, just to be real friendly.
One and a hug.
Left, right hug.
I go to this way first. That's my left. I don't know my lefts and rights still.
See, I think there's an interesting thing in
France. There's a failing in my education.
There's an interesting thing in France, which is what's the point at which men graduate to kissing. Because men,
when they're 13 years old?
In France, men kiss each other to the greeting friends.
With tongues?
Not with tongues. Well, some people do use tongues, but as friends, that's generally not advisable.
This is my favourite thing that's ever happened to me.
But what I think it's quite, because I was spending a bit of time there last year, what's the point at which you sort of graduate to that is an interesting question.
Oh, in your friendship?
Yes.
Right, okay, so...
I think it's quite nice, French men kissing, actually.
Is it at the same point?
Can I... Oh, please, can you isolate that? Please isolate that for me.
Is it the same point that you would stop using the VU form and start using the TU form?
Ah, interesting.
And is that a big thing when that suddenly happens?
It would. I would consider it a big thing if I was French. I'd take somebody out for dinner and say, I think we're ready to start using the TU form.
I think what's interesting about this is that we've not only got a role in the Jeffocracy for you, but you can go global with this role.
Yeah. Oh.
So you can succeed as a minister for you can be minister for the kissing in the Jeffocracy, and then you can basically make it a sort of international role.
Marvellous.
Kissing envoy.
Because the worst thing is when you do one too many kisses and then you feel like a pervert.
Has that happened to you?
Well, I was cupping something at the same time, but yeah.
Jess, you're on tour. The show is called No Filter.
It is, because I don't have one.
And you're going to be all around the country?
I'm everywhere. If you live in the UK, fantastic. I'm going there.
That is everywhere. Jess, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, we're in the outro.
No, that went fast.
Yeah, it did.
I enjoyed it.
Meaningful vote 2.5.
So will it then go to 3.5 or will there be a 3 in between? I'm very confused now. What increments? Could there be a meaningful vote 2.75?
Well, I think she's probably got a problem in bringing meaningful vote 2.5 back because of the ruling of the Speaker.
And 1604.
Maybe meaningful vote 3 is hard to bring back too. I think she might be a bit up the creek.
You'll sort it all out though, won't you? You'll save the country for us.
We'll do our best. Should we do some thank yous?
Yes.
I'd like to thank Fernanda Bellata, Nick Taylor and Sam Scriven.
And thanks to Jess Robinson. What a fantastic voice Jess has as well.
Absolutely.
Hugely entertaining. Emma Corsham produces our podcast with backup and research from Joel Pierce and Joe Kenyon. James Deacon made the iDents. Ed Seed composed the music and the artwork.
Emily Power.
So that's it. I think to celebrate our episode on coastal towns, we should go on a coach and go on a coach trip to the seaside.
Margate. I fancy Margate.
Let's do it.
Should we do it now? Should we elope?
Have you not got better things to be doing?
Maybe it'll all look clearer from Margate.
Looking across the English Channel.
Exactly.
Yeah. He's been Ed Kiss Me Quick Miliband.
He's been Jeff Squeeze Me Slowly Lloyd.
And these have been
Reasons to Be Beside the Seaside.